bend, perhaps, the open meetings law by opening a public hearing rather than a work session on House Bill 2944. Since we didn't notice a public hearing, but since the bill can't pass in public hearing, sort of no harm, no foul, I suppose. Council, can you bring us up to speed on House Bill 2944 as well as the two proposed amendments that are in front of us? I realize we kind of need Representative Mannix before we move into work session, but can you bring us up to speed on these things?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. There are also, I think, some witnesses here that can speak directly to the amendments. House Bill 2944 was originally a proposal to create a new system of commitment for individuals with alcoholism or substance abuse problems. The bill, as originally written, had a significant fiscal impact and I think was also a significant shift in policy from current procedures and practice. Representative Mannix, at that point, co-opted, I guess, a 1987 bill that also deals with the issue of potential commitment procedures for an individual who has problems with alcoholism or substance abuse. One of the key proposals or pieces of the legislation, and the committee has been provided with this at their dash 2 amendments dated 5/17, is found on page 3 of the bill of the printed amendments. Today's packet, page 3, okay. Lines 24, 5, and 6. This proposal states that a person making the notification and initiating the commitment process is responsible for ensuring funds. So as written, the bill has no fiscal impact. The other issue
is that not similar to different, same idea, different context for the guardianship bill that we passed here where the
Mr. Chair, no, the issue in the guardianship bill was only a payment of attorney's fees, okay. Provision of counsel. Ironically enough, this bill does provide for appointment of counsel, but the person who's seeking the commitment would be responsible for the treatment if it was to occur. The other issue that's being brought to the committee today, to the best of my ability to understand it, is that when an individual is present in an emergency room or in a hospital for an emergency commitment proceeding, they are not, the physician there is not able to request that that person be transferred to another facility. And Steve Telfer is here to discuss that amendment. It is also in the committee's packet, and it is marked, I think, dash 2. It really should be dash 3, though he didn't know that at the time.
And that's the idea that was wrapped up in Senate Bill 49 or something?
That's my understanding, which we have not seen.
Yes, okay. All right, so committee, take the non-LC-2 amendments that have the name Steve Telfer on them. Please designate those as dash 3 so we can keep ourselves clear. We will wait to hear about the dash 2 amendments from Representative Mannix when he gets here. And in the meantime, I'll ask Mr. Telfer and company to come up and talk to us about the dash 3 amendments.
Right. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, for the record, I'm Steve Telfer. I represent Legacy Health System. I have with me Dr. Howard Harrison, who's the medical director at Holiday Park Medical Center in Portland, and also Lieutenant Dave Butzer with the Portland Police Bureau, assigned to the Chief's Office. Basically, what we're attempting to accomplish here is to create some statutory authority to transfer from one hospital to another hospital somebody who is in need of psychiatric services. Today, under the current statutory scheme, no such authority exists, and as we get into a circumstance with a so-called two-physician hold that Dr. Harrison talks about, or will talk about, we literally are exposing both the police bureau and arguably any other person who transports somebody to liabilities because there is an absence of statutory authority to make that transfer. With that, I'd like to ask Dr. Harrison, who's provided some written testimony, to review that with you, and then Lieutenant Butzer to talk about the issue from the standpoint of the Portland Police Bureau.
My name is Howard Harrison. I have been practicing psychiatry in Oregon for the last 12 years, both in the public and private sectors. Currently, I am medical director for Behavioral Health Services at Holiday Park Medical Center in Portland. I also maintain a private practice of psychiatry. I come before you to advocate for the amendments to House Bill 2944 that would facilitate the transfer of a person on a two-physician hold from one hospital to another. Let me explain why these changes are needed. In Portland and other major cities in the state, not all hospitals have psychiatric units. However, most any hospital may have to treat a person who, because of a mental illness, is dangerous to self or others and requires a two-physician hold. Now, if this hold is signed at a hospital that does not have psychiatric treatment facilities, under current Oregon statutes, there is no legally specified way for this person on the hold to be transferred to a facility with a psychiatric treatment program. In Portland, we of Holiday Park's psychiatric treatment program have had problems accepting transfers of patients on holds from Good Samaritan, Emmanuel Kaiser, Mount Hood Medical Center, and others. We have resorted to a quasi-legal maneuver of signing two holds, one on either end of the transfer, then dropping the first hold when the patient gets to the second hospital. This has caused the probate court fits and exposes the hospital and the physician to potentially serious liability. If these amendments are accepted, they will facilitate these transfers and correct a problem with the mental health statutes that has existed since I began my practice in Oregon some dozen years ago. I might add that other states, for example, Minnesota, have such transfer authority in their mental health statutes. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Doctor. This committee has come to know and love Judge Johnson and has seen some of the probate court's fits this session in response to some other legislation, so we're familiar with the problem. Representative Bell.
Thank you. Would you define for me what a two-physician hold is? That's not something I'm familiar with.
Yes, under Oregon statutes, and I cannot give you the exact number, a physician practiced or licensed to practice medicine in the state of Oregon in consultation with another similarly qualified person, neither of whom are related to the patient, can hold a person in a hospital, in the psychiatric treatment facility, against that person's will if that patient is dangerous to self or others because of a mental illness. During that stay, the patient is evaluated by the court and it is determined if the patient should be released or sent on to a commitment hearing that could commit them to the mental health authority for 6 months.
Why is the having the hold at both ends such a problem legally?
I don't believe it's legal, and the problem is the statute does not specify how you put a two-physician hold at one hospital and get the person to the other hospital. There's no statutory authority to do that, and if there's no authority to do that, I'm concerned that we're going to be sued for kidnapping or assault or something like that in the near future. It's just an accident waiting to happen.
Judge Parks.
Tell me the mechanics of when you do that, assuming you would hold in the same hospital, then do you notify the court, and is there some time limit on which proceedings are initiated?
Yes. When the two-physician hold is signed, that paper is transmitted to the court as early as possible, usually the next judicial day. Also, the hospital unit will call the court and inform them that this hold is in place and is on its way.
Does that then become, in effect, a petition for an adjudication of mental illness?
In a way, yes, because the investigator from the court comes by and determines if a commitment hearing is warranted.
And then after that happens, it's just the ordinary court process.
Right.
And you're not proposing to change any of the process. You're just proposing to say that as part of the two-commitment hold, you would have the right to transfer them to another place pending the hearing.
Right.
Okay, I think I want to ask you a couple more questions, but I want to clarify with counsel. The concept of the bill still contain what I would call the involuntary treatment of a person who is an alcoholic?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parks, I think that the proponents of that bill are anticipating that it will not remain. So the answer is it depends.
Let me be a little more frank. It depends on whether we got in stuff the bill or whether we just add the proposed amendments to what's already in the bill.
The relating cost is such that this could stand independent.
Okay, so what we're really talking about is what we've just talked about.
Correct.
In
right.
Now, Representative Maddox has some other amendments on a different issue. But
okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I do have one clarification for Dr. Harrison. What I think all of you are telling us is you're not, the proposal that you brought to us is not in any way a substantive change to the commitment statute one way or the other. What you're really asking for is transfer authority.
Precisely.
That's it. We would like some authority to do what we do anyway and feel rather nervous about right now.
Well, I can understand why.
Thank you. Lieutenant Butler, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm Lieutenant Dave Butzer. I'm representing the Portland Police Bureau on this. And I, obviously, as the other people have, I'm here to discuss the evaluation and transportation issues as they relate to the mentally ill. If a two-physician hold for some reason is not an option for the doctor, the next option then is to call in a police officer. And a police officer then goes into a hospital or a physician's office or a clinic and then is required to evaluate the person and then make a determination whether or not the person meets a immediate danger or threat to themselves or others, then place a police officer hold on them, and then the police are in the business of transporting the person to the appropriate hospital. So two issues here are at stake. First of all, we're being asked to second-guess a doctor. The statute allows us to take the word of the doctor, but it does not require us to take the word of the doctor. And there have been issues where the person has previously been exhibiting behavior that would warrant it, but when the police officer gets there, he's supposed to view the person and make a determination, plus any other relevant information. And there's been cases where a police officer has overruled a physician. That should not occur. This should fix this problem. It will get the police officer out of the business of transporting and evaluating in a hospital situation.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for any of the panel? Counsel?
Mr. Telfer, perhaps you can answer this question better than anybody else. In the way that this was drafted, it's a new section to that part of the statute that deals with emergency and voluntary admissions. Would you have any objection if the committee specifically placed it somewhere within that statute so that it actually followed those parts of the statute that really talk about the two physician hold and the fact that the person must be retained in that specific hospital?
Mr. Chair, Counsel, I really wouldn't have a problem with that. I drafted these amendments, frankly, as an add-on to the original written bill. The only admonition I guess I would share with you is that we want to make sure that this covers any involuntary commitment for mental illness concern, and that's why I opted to choose this language about being made a part of 426-175 to 426-225. If you can craft a way to apply it to the two-physician hold, that would certainly suffice for our purposes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sanseri.
Are we also changing some definitions here or adding people who were involved in alcohol or drug abuse?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanseri, at this point we're not working off the bill at all.
Okay.
At this point we're working off the dash 3 amendments as a singular item.
The problem brought to us by these folks was wrapped up in Senate Bill 49, and for a variety of reasons that's plugged up in Senate Human Resources Committee, and so we're trying to.
So these changes will not be part of it, just this, okay.
At the moment.
At least
that's the issue that's in front of the committee and presented by these witnesses is the issue of the transfer.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanseri, depending on the outcome of the committee's deliberation on Representative Mannix's proposals, if those end up being too contentious, owing to the time deadlines that have been posed by the leadership, we would really appreciate it if possibly we could use this bill for this purpose only and get on with it.
You think it ought to go? Counsel, you think it ought to go at the end of 426175 as the new sub 4?
That's correct. And I can explain that if you want.
Well, we'll wait till we go into work session.
Okay.
Okay. Further questions for the witnesses? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being here. As long as we have five members here, I'll go ahead and move into work session on House Bill 2944. Representative Mannix, would you like to explain the Dash 2 amendments to us, please? I'm sorry?
Is something interesting?
No, I'm just tripping. Sorry about that. I just wanted to explain my bizarre conduct. That's inexplainable.
That's very helpful, Representative. What about for the first 4.5 months of the session?
We're dealing with a bill, and we'll talk about you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have here a set of Dash 2 amendments that reorient this process, and were designed to deal with a lot of the initial objections to the bill. The Dash 2 amendments actually take us back to a bill that was worked up in 1987. And the key component of the Dash 2 amendments addresses the main question here. What about the cost? Mm-hmm. The main question is that. And I've asked some of the proponents of this measure, if you had to pay for this commitment process, would you want it? And the answer is still yes. The Dash 2 amendments at page 3, lines 24 through 26, have some language there that doesn't quite accomplish that purpose. I was just working out some modification on this. The person making the notification in Section 4 of this Act is responsible for ensuring that funds are available to pay the cost of any treatment ordered as part of the commitment. That wasn't enough. The modified language would say is responsible for ensuring that funds are available to pay the costs attendant to examination, investigation, and treatment incurred as part of the commitment. Now, what we'd heard before was there are some communities where they're willing as a project to really work at people who ought to be committed for these kinds of reasons, that they were willing to do all kinds of things. And my challenge to them was, are you willing to raise the money to pay for the examination, investigation, and treatment? Not the actual court cost of the court process. That's something the state should absorb for any standard court petition. We charge a fee for filing a petition, but that's all. With that change, and with the whole change in the format of this bill, we're getting to a commitment system that meets the intention of those who are the original proponents, but also sets up a scheme, just as we did on the guardianship proceeding, by the way, where the person who wants to proceed had better make sure that the cost of the process is going to be taken care of, because we don't have the government funds right now to add this layer to the system. And that's probably the most important component of the Dash 2 amendments. Now, because I was working over this language right now, I didn't have a chance to focus on the discussion of the witnesses, but I understand they were focusing on the original bill.
No, they were focusing on an entirely separate issue, unrelated to your issue at all.
All right.
Representative Sensori.
Just a question, Representative Mannix. Appreciate the language that you are dealing with here in terms of cost. But if we establish something like this and we've got people that are picked up on the street or because of drugs or because of alcohol and they're taken to the psych unit and determined that they have a problem, what if they don't have the money? What if they're determined not to have the money? Are we just going to put them back out on the street?
Well, no, the person who wants to initiate this process is going to have to ensure that the money is available.
But if the money's not available, I'm just saying it's not there. What do we do? Sorry?
We're back where we are right now. Right now we don't have this law and we don't have this process. Unless people are shown to need commitment under the standards of the current law, and this bill won't take out the current law. The current law will be available for those who meet the standards of the current law. The problem is that the current law sets such a high commitment standard that we're not reaching out to help people who are at a lower level of need but still need treatment.
Let me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parks.
Let's kind of go through this, and you can help me with this. Initially, one of the definitions said that anybody had been convicted of driving under the influence and plus some others. Are those all gone from your proposed amendment? Here's the original. It's right on there.
Yeah, this is totally changed.
Okay.
Now it's going to be the court determines a person is incapacitated as a result of alcoholism or drug dependency. In order to find a person's incapacitated, the court must find that the person is an alcoholic or drug-dependent person whose health is deteriorating, as evidenced by the presence of one or more medical complications. It's either due to alcoholism or drug dependency, as certified by a physician. Or that the person is an alcoholic or drug-dependent person who, as a result, has threatened, inflicted, or attempted to inflict physical injury on that person's self or on another person.
Okay, fill in the blanks for me on page 2.
That's why am I laughing?
Ripley, because Ripley Parks, I didn't hear your comment.
There's some blanks on page 2. I want them to tell me what goes in the blanks.
That's what I'm still looking to the experts for some help on right now, is exactly what are the medical complications due to drug dependency, trying to define that. I'm still tempted to say means that which a physician is willing to certify, because every day we seem to find more medical complications due to drug dependency. And I don't know if Mr. Grundhofsen, if you can come, may he come up here and help us with this a bit?
Well, yeah, I'm going to ask him to come up in just a second.
Okay. Because I don't have the language for this section, is what I'm saying.
Let me ask, how many people in the audience are here to testify on House Bill 2944, or would like to be heard on the latest set of amendments?
2944.
One that we're.
I'm here to.
Okay.
Just to say that this seven step process is perfectly fine as far as the original citizens group that brought it forward.
Is what I'm particularly interested in is whether Dr. Libencott or any of his folks are here.
Sam's here.
Okay, good. Mr. Barker, were you planning on making some comments on the proposed amendments? Are you familiar with them?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Do you want to give them some time to
react?
That's
what I really would like to do. Representative Thayer.
I just wanted to ask Peter have you read the Dash 2 amendments?
Okay, hold on here. Let's do this. Wait a minute. What we're going to do is I'd like to get the Dash 2 amendments both to Mr. Barker and anyone else in the audience who's interested, so they have a chance to look at them. Because I think, Representative Max, I'd like to get some comment and some perspective on exactly what they do. It's 20 pages of amendments. It's hard to digest in a few seconds. And I think their expertise and perspective would be helpful. So, Representative Sanceri, did you have a question?
Specifically, I wanted to ask Peter Grundhofsen if the Dash 2's accomplished what they were originally trying to accomplish.
Okay.
In the bill.
Let's do this then. Let's close the work session temporarily on House Bill 2944 to give Mr. Barker a chance to look at the amendments so he can comment on them. Mr. Grundhofsen, would you be able to stick around for a little bit? Okay. Do you have a copy of the Dash 2's? All right, we will.
Chairman?
Representative Bell.
Can I ask Representative Mannix a question before we
sure.
move too far away? Because I'd like us to think about this as we deal with the amendments. Representative Mannix, based on these amendments and the bills that we've already passed out in regards to drug and alcohol treatment, are we basically setting up a system where a law-abiding person who can't afford it can't get treatment, but if they go out and slug somebody on the corner, then they would have treatment accessible to them?
It's not intended to move in that direction. It is intended. See, we're talking about someone who's threatened someone. No, there's going to have to be a petitioner who is willing to come forward, and the petitioners are not going to want to reward people for engaging in that kind of conduct. The moving party here is going to have to be the one who pays for this process.
But wasn't there a bill in regards to drug and alcohol assessment upon, you know, when they were convicted of a crime or something?
There's another bill for that.
Okay, yeah. Well, so if we've done that on one side, and on the other side we've said if you can afford it and, you know, bring your spouse forward or whoever, you can get treatment. But the law-abiding citizens in the middle who can't afford it are left without treatment.
Okay, let me cut this off and say that we're going to have time to debate the merits of the amendments and the bills when we reopen the work session. We've got several bills up, and I think probably the most convenient way to do this, to process the time, is to let the proponents and opponents of the bill spend a few minutes looking at the amendments, and then we'll come back later on today.
Can you ask if anybody needs them?
Now, we've got extra sets of the dash two if anyone else needs them. So we will temporarily close the work session on House Bill 2944 and open a work session on Senate Bill 376. Council, can you remind us about Senate Bill 376?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 376 was introduced, I think, at the request of the State Court Administrator and is a significant rewrite of Oregon's contempt statutes. I believe at the Chair's request, Representative Mannix worked with a group of individuals who, including the State Court Administrator's office, who brought some amendments or amendment requests to this committee the last time it was heard. Some of the issues that were brought to the committee were issues that had been addressed or raised with the Senate. Some of them were new. I'm not sure the easiest way to facilitate this. There is a memo dated today, I can't believe it's May 29th, from Norrie Cross that goes over the amendments. There are also A12 amendments that I can walk through the committee. The A12 amendments need some further revision.
Okay, let's do this. Let's bring Mr. Linden up. I see that he's here, as well as anyone he would like to bring up. We can, and I would reference the committee to your staff measure summary in today's packet. It, I think, will be helpful in reminding you what the bill does and where we've been on it. So, Mr. Linden, are the amendments in front of us yours?
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. The amendments dated May 27th, the A12 amendments, are the result of the discussions in the ad hoc group that Representative Mannix convened and presided over, and they are acceptable, and we agree with every one of them. We do have an additional amendment relating to one of the issues.
I don't think that's true. I think there's a mistake in there.
In the A12 amendments?
Yes. I think lines 22 through 24 on the first page.
I'm sorry, that is the additional the
there is, I made a mistake.
Amendment beyond.
Yes.
We have an amendment dated May 29th that's attached to my testimony that changes the language that you see on the A12 amendments beginning on line 22.
Mm-hmm. Could we stop for a minute?
Yeah.
What bill are we on?
Senate Bill 376.
And the last amendments we have are?
We have
your packets today.
We have some A12 amendments that were dated May 27th, and we have some more recent amendments than that that I think, frankly, we're having a hard time locating.
They're probably loose in front of you. They were not coordinated, unless they haven't been handed
they're
out.
They're on
yet.
Judicial Department letterhead. I don't believe they've been handed out.
Oh.
That's part of the confusion.
Oh, I don't know. Does Norrie still have these? Do you have this? Sorry. The other thing.
Okay, do one thing at a time. Here.
I know.
All right, committee.
Okay.
Attached to Mr. Linden's testimony, some amendments on dated May 29th. Let's mark those as dash 13, please, so that we can make reference to them. So what you're just being handed out, the amendments would be marked as dash 13s. All right, Mr. Linden, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My apology for not having that distributed. What I'll do is I'll run through the changes we've agreed on in the working group and identify who proposed them and what essentially they do. Starting with Section 5, Subsection 6, at the request of the District Attorney's Association, we've, in the A12 amendments, have provided language that recognizes that a defendant may waive the opportunity for a hearing by a stipulated order. And that's really an acknowledgement of current practice.
Mr. Chair, that's lines 5 and 6 of the A12 amendments, page 1.
Thank you. And that is a consensus item, is that right?
That's correct. I'm going to, on all of the A12 amendments, with the exception of the one beginning on line 20 to 20, on line 22 of page 1 of the A12 amendments, with that exception, it's my understanding that everything else in the A12 amendments are consensus and have been agreed upon by all the interested parties. Okay. So then moving on to the next section, section 6 and section 27A, these are Judicial Department suggestions, and what we've done here is avoided what we think is a constitutional problem of improperly shifting the burden to defendants in proceedings for the failure to pay a fine or restitution. And that, in the A12 amendments, I believe that is the amendment that begins on the first page, line 10. No, I'm sorry.
Line 8.
Programs, and I've been involved in it myself personally, taking people to these programs to be helped, that if they don't want to be there, I don't care how much money you spend on them or how long they're there, it doesn't work. It doesn't help. And I have a serious concern about forcing this rehabilitation, quote-unquote, on these people. I still have a question in my mind as to the constitutionality of it, even in terms of the Fifth Amendment. We're infringing on their liberty to do what they want to do in this country, but we do help them in terms of what you've described. We have detox centers, and they're picked up on the streets, and they're taken into these centers, and they're dried out. And it doesn't cost them anything, but to force them into a lengthy treatment for this kind of thing, I really have serious questions as to whether or not we have the right to do that.
Mr. Chairman, responding to Representative Sunseri, I have brought with me today Mr. Richard Harris, who is the longtime manager of the Detoxification Center in Multnomah County. We had hoped to have him testify at the original hearing on HB 2944. Unfortunately, he had to be out of the state on business on that day, and we brought here instead his immediate supervisor, Debbie Wood, who is the director of Central City Concern in downtown Portland. I have Mr. Harris here, and he can respond especially to that. If you'll recall, committee, testimony of the experts that I brought to the hearing was to the contrary, Representative, and that is that people can be involuntarily committed and successfully treated. The literature on the subject has a significant body of that work, and I'd let Mr. Harris speak to that.
Mr. Grunfosser and Mr. Harris, perhaps you could also. That's my understanding, and I share Representative Sunseri's concern also as one who has seen the alcoholic process and the commitment process again and again. And it seems to me that used to be 5, 10, 15 years ago, the sort of commonly accepted notion was you couldn't be helped unless you wanted to be helped. And now with so-called intervention and some of the other there's beginning to be some questions raised about that assumption. So I think Representative Sunseri has perhaps two concerns, one of which is the propriety of committing someone against their will in this whole area, and second is the effectiveness. And Mr. Harris, I appreciate your being here and wonder if you can talk with us about that.
Can Representative Bell. Can I respond to his comment before he starts? I would urge you to realize that there's two ways of looking at helping people. One is when the state government is paying for services, we weigh and balance effectiveness. And maybe even if it was 90% ineffective, we would choose not to offer services.
But when you get into the realm of the emotional and caring and people who are willing to pay money for it, they're willing to take big gambles. If it was my son, I would pay 10 times over again and again and again on the chance that that one time it would be successful. And what we're talking about here are groups or families that are willing to put out their money as many times, you know, or do whatever. And so I want you to consider that. We're not weighing it the same way we spend state dollars, that it has to be, show, you know, 55% effectiveness or better to make it a worthwhile cause. We are talking about people who have already have some caring and some emotion involved in here to go the extra mile. So,
well, Mr. Chair, can I respond to that?
Yes, Representative Sinceri, although I would say we're going to have time to debate the bill on itself once we finish with the witnesses.
Okay, but a couple of comments have been made here about what I've said. I want you to know that as recently as Saturday, I was involved in an intervention with a man who we had an intervention with about 3 months earlier, who went to a treatment center because everybody forced him to go, essentially, because we cared, and the insurance company paid for it. It wasn't government dollars. And here we are right back again in the same situation. I've had members of my family that we've committed over and over again to alcohol treatment, and the fact is they didn't want to be there, although they agreed to do it. And when they got out, they went right back to the same thing because someone else paid for it and didn't cost them anything. They didn't want to be there in the first place. And the fact is that that's the way most of these people are. Now, I'm not talking about 5 years ago. I was doing this 5 years ago, too. We're doing it now. Now, I've heard some people say, oh, yeah, well, maybe you can help people that don't want to be helped if it's done properly and all that stuff. And I just frankly have not seen it. And I've been involved in it a lot for many years. And I just don't see the value of it. So now to sit down and think about passing a law, because we're going to force these people by law to do this, I'm dubious.
Richard Harris, manager of Chemical Dependency and Housing Services for Central City Concern, and manager of the Hooper Center for 9.5 years. At the Hooper Center, we see a lot of people who are late-stage alcoholics and drug addicts who have passed through Hooper Center many times.
Mr. Harris, let me interrupt you and just tell you that, by way of anecdote, I practiced law for 6 years on Southeast Grand Avenue, about 3 blocks from Bologna Joe's, and I had the Hooper Center's phone number memorized.
Can you tell me? It's we've changed it, so you may, if you call it, you may find somebody else now. But.
Go ahead.
I really would like to respond to the issue about effectiveness of treatment and coerced or mandated treatment, because I think this comes to the middle part of this project, and that is that no alcohol and drug treatment is 100% effective. In fact, the literature will tell you that when you study alcoholism and chemical dependency over a long period of time, that people take many efforts at recovery to achieve a degree of freedom from drugs. There is no cure for alcoholism, and that if you believe what I believe is probably the only long-term study of alcoholism done by George Phelan at Harvard, where they studied individuals who were college men and blue-collar workers for over 40 years, of that group of people who were alcoholic, there was an average of 8 treatment episodes. And the reality is nobody recovers in one episode, or that's the very rare person. So without throwing a lot of cold water on the idea that alcoholism treatment isn't easy and we'll just commit them and they'll get better, I don't believe that either, because I've seen too many people in relapse, too many people who cycle through the system. But I have to tell you that in all the years at Hooper Center, I've watched too many people die on the streets when I have felt completely and totally impotent to intervene in their alcoholism, because we were unable to get them into a treatment facility long enough for them to gather their emotional, intellectual, and spiritual strength to continue on with their recovery. The states that have used involuntary commitment as the way to intervene with alcoholics have learned that involuntary or coerced or mandated treatment ends up being no less effective than the person who voluntarily goes into treatment. And I want to talk a little bit about the voluntary part, because
Representative Sanceri, what you described is perhaps the way most people get the treatment. They are coerced by somebody in their family, an employer, the court. There is somebody who is pushing on the alcoholic. The nature of the disease is such that most people avoid treatment and are in denial of their problems to the point where it does prevent them from going to treatment, and we often have to push them there. And it can be family members who push, or it can be employers who push. There is no 100% effective way to do this. The thing about this procedure is that it provides us with the last kind of push when the other things have failed. This is not the first thing we resort to. This is the last thing we resort to. In the state of Washington, which has done involuntary commitment for years now, what they have learned is that about 90% of the individuals who are brought to somebody's attention, the investigator or the authority's attention, to need commitment, are individuals who never get committed. They agree to go to treatment because they believe that the treatment process will eventually send them to one of the treatment facilities, and rather do that, they stipulate and go to treatment anyway. So the effectiveness of this kind of a statute is that people will voluntarily admit themselves to treatment, or I should say semi-voluntarily, because they have this hanging over their head. Now, in the case of late-stage chronic alcoholics who we're talking about, these people that are damaged because of these medical conditions and their state of incapacity meaning that they're unable to form any rational decision about seeking help, are individuals that do quite well if they're held in a place long enough for their bodies to start to heal and for their minds to start to heal. Given the option that they can walk away from the place and just leave willy-nilly, most of those late-stage chronic alcoholics don't stay in treatment. And what they do, what does happen to them, is that they go to the treatment facility, they relapse, they go back out on the street, they begin drinking again, and they end up in the hospital. They end up for 300 admissions into the detox center and unable to control themselves. So it's apparent to me from watching this process from the street level that unless you provide a place for those individuals to be, which won't allow them just to nilly-willy walk off for 30 or 60 days, is that we don't stand a chance in getting them clean and sober. And I wouldn't say this is the first thing you apply. This is the last thing you apply to people. Sorry for the speech.
It's a good one.
Further questions, Representative Parks.
I'm sorry I didn't get your name because I was...
Richard Harris.
Mr. Harris, I have acted as a guardian for people, put them in a treatment, and kept them there under 126, the guardianship statute. And I was able to do that because there were funds available, and I was a responsible person. And I don't understand why we need this law when we have 126, which allows you to do exactly what you folks want to do.
Well, I guess that we don't believe that it mandates people to go to treatment. It may mandate them into custody of somebody, or it may be up to a probate judge to tell them what to do, but there's no system in place to do it. This would put a system in place that defines the civil liberties of the individual very carefully. And I think we've had, this is the fifth legislature we've talked about this issue, and we've talked about it from a civil liberties point of view a lot in the past, and although that wasn't the intent of me being here, I think the purpose of drafting this particular bill is that there is a very specific civil liberties protections defined in this bill. And I'm very concerned about depriving people unnecessarily of their civil liberties, and I think that this bill defines that process in such a way that it won't be abused.
And I forget what the general guardianship is, but I know it's not for 6 months. I know a temporary guardianship or even a permanent guardianship is not reviewable, and you have in your you have a 6-month outer limit in your proposal here, and I guess you take that as necessary. Let me say this: this is a very real problem, and I'm not trying to minimize it. And I think there's a lot of people that aren't making rational decisions because they can't. But I want to make sure that it's limited to those people and not to people that are choosing of their own volition to live a way that you don't think they ought to live.
Well, I think that the individuals that I've come to know at the Hooper Center quite intimately over the years, because they have been repeaters, are people who are sincere about treatment and sincere about breaking the cycle of addiction. They're just physically incapable of doing it. The motives are real clear to me. Nobody wants to live that way. But the power of addiction is so strong that the physical nature just overpowers anybody's good intentions.
Thank you, Representative Parks. Thank you very much, Mr. Harrison. We appreciate you being here.
May I ask a further question?
Representative Mannix.
My legislative assistant suggested maybe I could ask you for this. We had not listed in here, because we hadn't gotten it from any kind of an authority, medical complications due to drug dependency. Now, can you refer us to someone that we could turn to get some information on that, or do you have some suggestions as to what we might be able to deal with in terms of that language?
Well, interesting, that was left blank, because during the last, this was introduced in 1987, the Charlie Shade, who was the medical director of Multnomah County, left to go to work in Washington, D.C., and left us without finishing this off, and the bill wasn't going anywhere, so it languished. I would suggest there are a number of addictionologists in the state that could do this. Dr. Bird would be one. I would suggest Dr. Kohlberg of Multnomah County, who is the medical director of the Hooper Center in Multnomah County. I would fill in on the top blank here, since 1987, HIV is the word that belongs here. Because this is precisely what's happened in the four intervening years, is that drug addicts who share needles end up getting HIV disease, and that's the principle, this debilitating drug addiction physical condition right now. And there are, of course, a number of others, but not being a MD, I wouldn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, can I ask a question?
Representative Parks.
What are you going to do for somebody with HIV? You're going to commit them to treatment in what I would guess is the last months of their life without any way to...
Interesting. At the Hooper Center, we probably have in any one day two or three individuals in there who are HIV positive. The average length of their life with HIV is... that can be now up to 6-7 years. So it isn't necessarily individuals who are in the very latter stages of this disease. I suspect that most of those individuals will be in care facilities already where their access to drugs and alcohol is pretty limited. But certainly in earlier stages of it, it's a possibility. And if you think about the implications of that a minute, an HIV-positive individual who is still actively using alcohol and drugs is actively spreading that disease around the community. And if they're in recovery where they're not using alcohol and drugs, they are not spreading that disease.
But that's a whole different issue.
But for the individual, I'm just saying for the individual, they have an access to treatment that they may not have otherwise.
I think what's really concerning to me, and most of these sound very significant from a physiological standpoint, but those things do not necessarily deprive a person of the ability to make a conscious decision
right. On
what's for their own welfare. And I don't know what this adds to enumerate serious conditions.
Well, I would say that when I saw the bill was originally introduced and it had two DUIs, I said, oh my goodness, that isn't the condition that we're talking about here. I don't know where that came from, but I'm glad to see it go away. It's a matter of incapacity, dangerous to self or others, and these physical conditions. And the point of adding the physical conditions was that it took it out of the realm of guesswork. It put it into the realm of where you can run a test for cirrhosis. You can determine how damaged the person's liver really is, as opposed to having three psychiatrists come in and say this person is not making a rational decision. So the whole intent of putting the physical conditions was to make it more objective.
And I asked the other fellow, cirrhosis, isn't that a real common condition for somebody who abuses alcohol?
In the later stages, it's an indicator of late-stage alcoholism. Early-stage alcoholics would not have cirrhosis.
Thank you, Dr. Parks. Thank you very much. Okay, I appreciate that. All right. Committee, we are in work session on House Bill 2944.
The chair
will start off by moving the dash 3 amendments.
Dash 2 or dash 3?
Dash 3. Those are those presented by Mr. Telfer on behalf of Legacy Health Systems. And give the health providers transport authority to cover the sticky situation that they discussed with us. Is there discussion of those of the Dash 3 amendment? Is there objection to the Dash 3 amendment? Is it adopted? Representative Mannix.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would move the Dash 2 amendments. And I'm going to present certain modifications as part of the motion, or do you want me to make those as separate motions?
All right. Then we will take your motion as a motion to adopt the Dash 2 as a working document, and then we will further amend it. Okay. Is there any objection to using the Dash 2s as a working document, which basically guts the previous bill and goes with the Dash 2s as at least the beginning point of a substitution?
I want to just toss this out, this thought, and I don't object to that. I think what they talked about in the Dash 3 amendments is a very significant problem, and that we really ought to try and address that. And if we get to the point where this is a very tenuous bill, I wonder if it's wise to put them together.
Representative Parks, I appreciate that concern, and I spoke with the folks from Legacy about that as well. Here's what I suggest, that we do battle on the Dash 2s, see where we end up, and then if the bill goes to full committee, if there are problems in the full committee, we can bring the bill back and at least make sure that the transport legislation gets out. We are not, unlike some committees, we're not under a deadline on hearing bills. So I appreciate the concern. Representative Mannix. Okay, so objection to using the Dash 2s as a working document. Hearing none, they are adopted.
On the Dash 2, I move to amend the language at page 2 as follows. Where it says a court must find specifically that, change it to a court must specifically find by clear and convincing evidence that.
You're on line 28.
I'll give that to counsel when we're done. But we're requiring a clear and convincing evidence standard here.
All right. Further discussion of that proposed amendment? Is there objection to that proposed amendment? Hearing none, it is adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
On line 30 of page 2, I propose that we insert a phrase after the word person, where it says the person, the second time we use person, where it says the person is an alcoholic or drug-dependent person, insert the following phrase, who is not capable of exercising independent judgment as to the person's own welfare, and. And the reason for that motion is to get to the issue that we're trying to say, that we're not just saying you've got a drug problem or an alcohol problem. The judge has to say you are not capable of exercising independent judgment as to your welfare, and that's why we're getting into this process in the first place.
Representative Mannix moves on page 2, line 30, after the second use of the word persons, the words, who is not capable of exercising independent judgment.
As to the person's own welfare.
As to the person's own welfare.
And then we pick up whose health is.
Okay. Attempting to put one more safeguard in there, I assume. Further discussion of that proposed amendment. Is there objection to that amendment? It is adopted.
Mr. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
On page 3 of the Dash 2 amendments, line 23, change the initial commitment period from 6 months, limit it to 3 months.
Representative Mannix moves page 3, line 23, deletion of the word 6 and insertion of the word 3. Further discussion of that amendment. Representative Mannix, I appreciate that change. That's one that I had communicated to. Representative Mannix would help me with the bill, and I appreciate that change. Is there objection to that change? Hearing none, it is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
Lines 24 to 26, I recommend a remove that we change the language. So actually 25 and 26, so it'll read, and I'll read this and I'll show you the insert. The person making the notification in Section 4, Sub 1 of this Act is responsible for ensuring that funds are available to pay, and now we're going to start changing, the costs attendant to examination, investigation, and treatment incurred as part of the commitment. I'll read that again. So we did change cost to costs and then insert the phrase attendant to examination, investigation, and treatment incurred as part of the commitment.
Counsel. Representative Mannix has moved on line 25, page 3, after the word pay, insertion of words, the costs attendant to the examination, investigation, and treatment incurred as part of the commitment.
To that motion.
Representative Mannix.
This was designed to make it clear that anyone who wants to avail themselves, these are the petitioners we're talking about, of this process, have got to make sure that they've got a community program or they have private assets available to take care of the expense. That's how this process will work. And unfortunately, we're working on other legislation for drug treatment and rehab programs with government funds. This is to be a non-government funded. Unless it's a local government agency, if they come up with the funds, then they could use this process.
Council.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, by doing that and by having some different definitions, you're creating a system that's almost identical to the guardianship provisions or the guardianship statutes and process, particularly when you do this and you do some of the other definitional changes. And I don't know what the ramifications of that are, but I just wanted to point it out because it may create a situation. It may or may not be a situation that you want, but in fact, with that change, it'd be no different really than filing a guardianship petition.
Mr. Chairman? At some point, we may be merging these systems, but I'm a realist. We don't have that guardianship bill signed into law this session. We may not get this bill signed into law this session. I'm talking about the temporary guardianship bill that we were working on. Are you talking about the current guardianship statute?
And the current guardianship law would let you do a lot of this conceptually.
Yes, except the moving parties. The people who can move in this kind of direction under this legislation are, I'd say, more broadly defined, and they have less follow-up responsibility in terms of the personal finances or whatever else of the individual. This, in a way, the parties who can move on this are broader than they might be in a guardianship, and the kind of activity that you follow under this is narrower, and beyond that, because we're talking about an involuntary commitment, it bothers me to use the guardianship process for these kinds of commitments. And this bill has got very tough standards in here as far as review and psychologists and physicians examining and making reports. And it's deliberately tougher because we're talking about a limitation of liberty if an involuntary commitment is allowed. So it's somewhere between guardianship and what I'll call the mental health commitment process.
Counsel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, this bill also allows for court-appointed counsel both on the hearing level and the trial level. Do you want to put in attorney's fees in that new revised section?
I think that we ought to. That was the intention.
You might want to, because I don't know that it'd be, I don't know it would be included
including
in examination
attorney
and
fees,
investigation.
Including any reasonable attorney fees.
All right. Representative Mannix amends his motion to include reasonable attorney fees so that we're not draining the Indigent Defense Fund. Is there objection to the motion? Okay, it is adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
One other amendment to propose here, and this is a conceptual amendment that is going to be a little strange, but in terms of medical complications due to drug dependency, I would propose that we have a couple of physicians simply provide us with a list of what are generally accepted medical complications due to drug dependency.
You're talking about the blanks on page 2 of the bill?
Yes. But these are going to have to be approved by this committee. They're going to have to take a look at the list, but I'm not capable right now of giving you a list.
Let me suggest this, Representative Mannix. Let me suggest that we leave that open, that when the bill, assuming the bill makes it to full committee, that at the full committee we offer those in the nature of technical amendments.
But that we make it clear to people better take a good look at them.
Right.
And if there's a problem, then we should refer the bill back to subcommittee.
I think that's the way to handle that. So that we have a look at them before we're asked to vote on them, because I'm uncomfortable taking that as a conceptual amendment with that much openness.
I appreciate that, Mr.
We'll leave the bill with those blanks in it for right now.
Otherwise, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the bill as amended to the full committee, recognizing the need for that technical amendment.
All right. Representative Mannix moves House Bill 2944 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion on the bill, and before we kick that off, let me just ask the committee members to stick around for a bit. We have floor session at 5. I'd like to bring House Bill 3516 back, the one that was tabled a few minutes ago, for the purposes of having some amendments presented to the committee. So stick around, please. The bill, House Bill 2944 as amended, has been moved to the full committee. Further discussion?
I would wonder if you'd be interested in changing this, whose health is deteriorating, to something a little bit more severe than that.
I'm open to that.
Representative Parks.
Show me your mastery of the English language and give me a fast change for I want to, their health
substantially
to be in severe danger.
Representative Parks, let me offer a friendly amendment. What if the phrase was whose health has substantially deteriorated? It adds the word substantially and puts it in the past tense. Will that help?
Yep.
I agree with that.
Right. Representative Mannix amends his motion to the full committee so that on page 2 and 3 of the dash 2 amendments, the phrase whose health is deteriorating is changed to whose health has substantially deteriorated.
To the full motion, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
This bill is not being offered simply out of some idealistic notion that someone somewhere will work on it. There is a substantial community action group in Portland which has already come forward and said, give us the opportunity and we will proceed. We want to work with these folks. Now, I don't know if this is going to succeed or not. And I'm realistic, as I think Representative Sinceri pointed out, about all the dynamics of this.